Chapter 4. Frescoes from the past. Apparently the river was ready for business now. But no, the distribution of a population along its banks was as calm and deliberate and time-devouring a process as the discovery and exploration had been. 70 years elapsed after the exploration before the river's borders had a white population worth considering, and nearly 50 more before the river had a commerce. Between LaSalle's opening of the river and the time when it may be said to have become the vehicle of anything like a regular and active commerce, 7 sovereigns had occupied the throne of England, America had become an independent nation, Louis-XV, and Louis-XV had rotted and died, the French monarchy had gone down in the red tempest of the Revolution, and Napoleon was a name that was beginning to be talked about. Truly, there were snails in those days. The river's earliest commerce was in great barges, keelboats, broadhorns. They floated and sailed from the upper rivers to New Orleans, changed cargoes there, and were tediously warped and pulled back by hand. A voyage down and back sometimes occupied 9 months. In time this commerce increased until it gave employment to hordes of rough and hardy men, rude, uneducated, brave, suffering terrific hardships with sailor-like stoicism, heavy drinkers, coarse frolickers in moral styes like the Natchez under the hill of that day, heavy fighters, reckless fellows, everyone, elephantinely jolly, foul-witted, profane, prodigal of their money, bankrupt at the end of the trip, fond of barbaric finery, prodigious braggarts, yet, in the main, honest, trustworthy, faithful to promises and duty, and often picturesquely magnanimous. By and by the steamboat intruded. Then for 15 or 20 years, these men continued to run their keelboats downstream, and the steamers did all of the upstream business, the keelboatmen selling their boats in New Orleans, and returning home as deck passengers in the steamers. But after a while the steamboats so increased in number and in speed that they were able to absorb the entire commerce, and then keelboating died a permanent death. The keelboatman became a deckhand, or a mate, or a pilot on the steamer, and when steamer berths were not open to him, he took a berth on a Pittsburgh coal flat, or on a pine raft constructed in the forests up toward the sources of the Mississippi. In the heyday of the steamboating prosperity, the river from end to end was flaked with coal fleets and timber rafts, all managed by hand, and employing hosts of the rough, characters whom I have been trying to describe. I remember the annual processions of mighty rafts that used to glide by Hannibal when I was a boy, an acre or so of white, sweet-smelling boards in each raft, a crew of 2 dozen men or more, 3 or 4 wigwams scattered about the raft's vast level space for storm quarters, and I remember the rude ways, and the tremendous talk of their big crews, the ex-keelboatmen and their admiringly patterning successors. For we used to swim out a quarter or third of a mile, and get on these rafts, and have a ride. By way of illustrating keelboat talk and manners, and that now departed and hardly remembered raft life, I will throw in this place, a chapter from a book which I have been working at, by fits and starts, during the past 5 or 6 years, and may possibly finish in the course of 5 or 6 more. The book is a story which details some passages in the life of an ignorant village boy, Huck Finn, son of the town drunkard of my time out west, there. He has run away from his persecuting father, and from a persecuting good widow who wishes to make a nice, truth-telling, respectable boy of him, and with him a slave of the widow's has also escaped. They have found a fragment of a lumber raft. It is high water and dead summer time, and are floating down the river by night, and hiding in the willows by day, bound for Cairo, whence the Negro will seek freedom in the heart of the free states. But in a fog, they pass Cairo without knowing it. By and by they begin to suspect the truth, and Huck Finn is persuaded to end the dismal suspense by swimming down to a huge raft which they have seen in the distance ahead of them, creeping aboard under cover of the darkness, and gathering the needed information by eavesdropping. But you know a young person can't wait very well when he is impatient to find a thing out. We talked it over, and by Jim said it was such a black night now that it wouldn't be no risk to swim down to the big raft and crawl aboard and listen. They would talk about Cairo because they would be calculating to go ashore there for a spree, maybe, or anyway they would send boats ashore to buy whiskey or fresh meat or something. Jim had a wonderful level head for a nigger. He could most always start a good plan when he wanted one. I stood up and shook my rags off and jumped into the river and struck out for the raft's light. By and by, when I got down nearly to her, I eased up and went slow and cautious. But everything was all right, nobody at the sweeps. So I swung down along the raft till I was most abreast the campfire in the middle, then I crawled aboard and inched along, and got in amongst some bundles of shingles on the weather side of the fire. There was 13 men there, they was the watch on deck of course. And a mighty rough looking lot too. They had a jug, and tin cups, and they kept the jug moving. One man was singing roaring, you may say, and it wasn't a nice song for a parlor anyway. He roared through his nose, and strung out the last word of every line very long. When he was done they all fetched a kind of Injun war whoop, and then another was sung. It begun. There was a woman in our town did dwell. She loved her husband dear I Lee, but another man twist as wed. Singing to, Rilu, 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 Rai to, Rilu, Rile, E, she loved her husband dear I Lee, but another man twist as wed. And so on 14 verses. It was kind of poor, and when he was going to start on the next verse one of them said it was the tune the old cow died on, and another one said, oh, give us a rest. ... and another one told him to take a walk. They made fun of him till he got mad, and jumped up and begun to cuss the crowd, and said he could lame any thief in the lot. They was all about to make a break for him, but the biggest man there jumped up, and says, set where you are, gentlemen. Leave him to me, he's my meat. ... Then he jumped up in the air 3 times, and cracked his heels together every time. He flung off a buckskin coat that was all hung with fringes, and says, you lay thar tell the chawin upstun, ... and flung his hat down, which was all over ribbons, and says, you lay thar tell his sufferings is over. ... Then he jumped up in the air, and cracked his heels together again, and shouted out, woo-oop. I'm the old original iron-jawed, brass-mounted, copper-bellied corpse maker from the wilds of Arkansas. Look at me. I'm the man they call sudden death and general desolation. Sired by a hurricane, damned by an earthquake, half-brother to the cholera, nearly related to the smallpox on the mother's side. Look at me. I take 19 alligators and a barrel of whiskey for breakfast, when I'm in robust health, and a bushel of rattlesnakes and a dead body when I'm ailing. I split the everlasting rocks with my glance, and I squench the thunder when I speak. Woo-oop! Stand back and give me room according to my strength. Blood's my natural drink, and the wails of the dying is music to my ear. Cast your eye on me, gentlemen. And lay low and hold your breath, for I'm about to turn myself loose. ... All the time he was getting this off, he was shaking his head and looking fierce, and kind of swelling around in a little circle, tucking up his wristbands, and now and then straightening up, and beating his breast with his fist, saying, look at me, gentlemen. ... When he got through, he jumped up, and cracked his heels together 3 times, and let off a roaring woo-oop. I'm the bloodiest son of a wildcat that lives. ... Then the man that had started the row tilted his old slouch hat down over his right eye. Then he bent stooping forward, With his back sagged and his south end sticking out far, and his fists a-shoving out and drawing in front of him, and so went around in a little circle about 3 times, swelling himself up and breathing hard. Then he straightened, and jumped up, and cracked his heels together 3 times, before he lit again.
That made them cheer,
and he begun to shout like this, "Whoop, bow your neck and spread, for the kingdom of sorrow's a-coming. Hold me down to the earth, for I feel my powers a-working, whoop. I'm a child of sin, don't let me get a start. Smoked glass, here, for all. Don't attempt to look at me with the naked eye, gentlemen. When I'm playful I use the meridians of longitude, and parallels of latitude for a seine, and drag the Atlantic Ocean for whales. I scratch my head with the lightning, and purr myself to sleep with the thunder. When I'm cold, I bile the Gulf of Mexico, and bathe in it. When I'm hot I fan myself with an equinoctial storm. When I'm thirsty I reach up, and suck a cloud dry like a sponge. When I range the earth hungry, famine follows in my tracks. Whoop! Bow your neck and spread. I put my hand on the sun's face, and make it night in the earth. I bite a piece out of the moon and hurry the seasons. I shake myself and crumble the mountains. Contemplate me through leather, don't use the naked eye. I'm the man with a petrified heart and biler iron bowels. The massacre of isolated communities is the pastime of my idle moments. The destruction of nationalities the serious business of my life. The boundless vastness of the great American desert is my enclosed property, and I bury my dead on my own premises. ". He jumped up, and cracked his heels together 3 times, before he lit.
They cheered him again,
and as he come down he shouted out, "Whoop, bow your neck and spread, for the pet child of calamity's a-coming." Then the other one went to swelling around, and blowing again. The first one, the one they called Bob. Next, the child of calamity chipped in again, bigger than ever. Then they both got at it at the same time, swelling round and round each other, and punching their fists most into each other's faces, and whooping and jawing like engines. Then Bob called the child names, and the child called him names back again. Next, Bob called him a heap rougher names, and the child come back at him with the very worst kind of language. Next, Bob knocked the child's hat off, and the child picked it up, and kicked Bob's ribbony hat about 6 foot. Bob went and got it and said, "Never mind, this weren't going to be the last of this thing," because he was a man that never forgot and never forgive, and so the child better look out, for there was a time a-coming, just as sure as he was a living man, that he would have to answer to him with the best blood in his body. The child said no man was willinger than he was for that time to come, and he would give Bob fair warning now, never to cross his path again, for he could never rest till he had waded in his blood, for such was his nature, though he was sparing him now on account of his family, if he had one. Both of them was edging away in different directions, growling and shaking their heads and going on about what they was going to do. But a little black-whiskered chap skipped up, and says, "Come back here, you couple of chicken-livered cowards, and I'll thrash the two of ye." ". And he done it too. He snatched them, he jerked them this way and that, he booted them around, he knocked them sprawling faster than they could get up. Why, it weren't 2 minutes till they begged like dogs, and how the other lot did yell, and laugh and clap their hands all the way through, and shout, "Sail in, corpse maker! ". Hi! At 'em again, child of calamity! ". Bully for you, little Davy! ". Well, it was a perfect powwow for a while. Bob and the child had red noses, and black eyes when they got through. Little Davy made them own up, that they were sneaks and cowards, and not fit to eat with a dog or drink with a nigger. Then Bob and the child shook hands with each other, very solemn, and said they had always respected each other, and was willing to let bygones be bygones. So then they washed their faces in the river,
and just then there was a loud order to stand by for a crossing, and some of them went forward to man the sweeps there, and the rest went aft to handle the after sweeps. I laid still and waited for 15 minutes, and had a smoke out of a pipe that one of them left in reach. Then the crossing was finished, and they stumped back, and had a drink around, and went to talking and singing again. Next they got out an old fiddle, and one played and another padded juba, and the rest turned themselves loose on a regular old-fashioned keelboat breakdown. They couldn't keep that up very long without getting winded, so by and by they settled around the jug again. They sung Jolly Jolly Raftman's The Life for Me, apostrophe with amusing chorus, and then they got to talking about differences betwixt hogs, and their different kind of habits, and next about women and their different ways, and next about the best ways to put out houses that was afire, and next about what ought to be done with the engines, and next about what a king had to do, and how much he got, and next about how to make cats fight, and next about what to do when a man has fits, and next about differences betwixt clear water rivers and muddy water ones. The man they called Etz at the muddy Mississippi water was wholesomer to drink than the clear water of the Ohio. He said if you let a pint of this yaller Mississippi water settle, you would have about a half to three quarters of an inch of mud in the bottom, according to the stage of the river, and then it warn't no better than Ohio water. What he wanted to do was to keep it stirred up, and when the river was low, keep mud on hand to put in and thicken the water up the way it ought to be. The child of calamity said that was so. He said there was nutritiousness in the mud, and a man that drunk Mississippi water could grow corn in his stomach if he wanted to. He says, you look at the graveyards. That tells the tale. Trees won't grow worth chucks in a Cincinnati graveyard, but in a St. Louis graveyard they grow upwards of 800 foot high. It's all on account of the water the people drunk before they laid up. A Cincinnati corpse don't rich in a soil any. ... And they talked about how Ohio water didn't like to mix with Mississippi water. Ed said if you take the Mississippi on a rise, when the Ohio is low, you'll find a wide band of clear water all the way down the east side of the Mississippi for 100 miles or more, and the minute you get out a quarter of a mile from shore and pass the line, it is all thick, and yaller the rest of the way across. Then they talked about how to keep tobacco from getting moldy, and from that they went into ghosts and told about a lot that other folks had seen. But Ed says, why don't you tell something that you've seen yourselves? Now let me have a say. 5 years ago I was on a raft as big as this, and right along here it was a bright moonshiny night, and I was on watch and boss of the starboard or forward, and one of my parts was a man named Dick Albright, and he come along to where I was sitting, forward, gaping and stretching. He was and stooped down on the edge of the raft, and washed his face in the river, and come and sat down by me, and got out his pipe, and had just got it filled, when he looks up, and says, "Hi, looky here," he says, "ain't that Buck Miller's place, over yander in the bend?" "S," says I, "it is, why?" He laid his pipe down, and leant his head on his hand, and says, "Thought we'd be further down." I says, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.